Now, Meg and I have prepared an entertainment for you, and it's just an entertainment, and it's a sort of unprepared but long prepared from both of our work and our work together. And she's going to, I'm going to talk about a psychoanalytic, that is my psychoanalytic viewer, about creativity as an aspect of the human condition. And Meg's going to talk about Hamlet as an example of that. Taking Hamlet really as a person and not taking Hamlet as an emanation of another person named Shakespeare, but Hamlet as a person, perhaps more real in a certain sense than Shakespeare. And I'm going to talk about the a view of the human condition of which I say creativity, which I believe that there is such a thing as creativity because I see evidences of it in books and museums and concert halls and so on. It must exist. I can't say I have any personal experience of it, but I see traces of it in patients occasionally, a poet, an author, a painter. But the idea of it and the idea of the human condition of which it is a facet has grown very slowly, I mean, starting from when I first became interested in psychoanalysis when I was 16 and didn't know what I was getting into, until very recent years when Wilfred Bion's work finally made its impact on me. And in a sense sort of changed in a certain way my way of thinking about everything. Another recent influence has been working with a pediatrician and psychotherapist named Romana Negri in Milan, watching babies in utero, watching their behavior, which was particularly interesting because we were studying the behavior of non-identical twins with one another in utero, and then following it with infant observation and into nursery school and indefinitely. And that has been a very convincing experience that that mental life and the formation of character and picture of the world starts very, very early, at least around 3 months, I would say, 3 months in gestation, and is already immensely formed by the time the baby is born. She also has for a long time studied premature babies and has written a beautiful book about the struggle that they have about coming into the world prematurely before they're equipped for that transition, which gives a lot of insight into the nature of the transition. And it is really the nature of that transition from life in utero to life outside, which is very much the key to my ideas about aesthetics, what I call aesthetic conflict, and its role in the human condition, and certainly its role in the aspiration toward creativity. Observation of fetal life is very convincing that life in there is very lovely to a certain point when it becomes uncomfortably constricted and so on. And that it's lovely because, in fact, the baby has all of its senses available in a very, very soft light, in very muted auditory connections with the mother, with the world, the companionship of the placenta, which really supplies it with everything that it needs. It is really, until the time comes for birth, when there is real fetal distress, its fetal distress is unknown to the fetus in the normal course of gestation. But one supposes that there is one thing that is lacking in uterine life, and that is interest. The rhythms, the, in a sense, coziness of that situation, probably does not arouse sufficient anxiety to focus mental processes that could be called interest. But of course, as soon as the baby is born and the intensified auditory and visual and probably gustatory and olfactory senses, the intensified sensual bombardment, which is accompanied by a new experience of helplessness, because particularly the impact of gravity on the newborn baby must come as a terrible shock, as if it were suddenly paralyzed and taken all of its powers away. Whereas in utero, it is extremely active and free and weightless, as it were. And that shock, of course, is accompanied also by the shock of the loss of the placenta, the intense distress which initiates breathing, the shock of temperature change, which is only modified to the extent that the attentions of the mother or attending people try to minimize this temperature shock and so on. The baby has a terrific, shocking experience, which is, if the baby is fortunate, brings it to the breast and to the breast contact with the mother. And that is, as Wilfred Bion has taught us, is not just a contact with the mother's breast and the milk and so on, but it is a contact with the mother's mind, which is manifest in her every response to the baby, the way she holds the baby, the way she looks, the way she talks to the baby, the way she thinks about the baby, the way she shares the baby's anxieties and so on. And that experience coming out of this bombardment and shock and the finding of this breast mother, this thinking breast mother, that juxtaposition would seem to initiate the mental processes of interest. And that interest, which Bion calls K, the thirst for knowledge, the desire to understand, the desire to know another person, that interest pulls together all of the baby's emotional capabilities, which Bion really separated into two large categories of love and hate. The interest pulls them together to form a, in a sense, a mixture or an integration that can reasonably be called a passionate response, compounded of loving and hating, held together by intense interest in this object and the nature of the relationship that it offers, which is, in its obvious sense, a feeding relationship, of feeding the body, but in its more important sense, of feeding the mind, a contact of mind to mind, which is a new experience. And I take it to be a thrilling experience, and the reason I take it as such is really drawn from psychoanalytic experience, the things that happen toward the end of a good analysis. Good meaning that the patient has developed, and that this development produces an experience of happiness that has very little to do with pleasure and pain, but has to do with this experience of developing. And in the very later months of an analysis that's coming to an end, that has been a developing experience, which means also for the therapist that the patient becomes alive to the beauty of the world in a way that is very different from how they had lived before. I mean, all of us tend to live in two very different ways. I mean, one is a sort of newspaper view of the world, which is terrible, and which sort of sweeps together all the dirt and presents it as food. And then there's another experience of the world to which we are guided by our contacts with art and science that focuses our interest, enables us to notice things which we otherwise wouldn't notice, and enables us to react emotionally to things that would just pass us by or disappear into the depths of the unconscious and not be worked over adequately. This aesthetic view of the world would seem naturally to start for the baby, for fortunate babies, with this sharp juxtaposition of the chaos and crisis of being born, of emerging from the womb, and finding this new and intensely interesting object that pulls together its emotionality and, in a sense, imposes upon it a passionate experience. But the problem seems to be that passionate experience is really only tolerable for the moments in which the baby experiences that its passion is reciprocated. At the moments when the mother is fully attending the baby, when she is both feeding it physically and mentally, when she is enthralled and seeing the baby as an aesthetic object, as a wonder of the creativity of the world and so on, which of course a mother cannot feed the baby that kind of experience continually. It has, fortunate babies have at least moments of it, of that sort of reciprocity which fills it with hope and which enables it to tolerate something that arises in it out of its previous experience, because its previous experience has been living inside that mother, and everything about the sensual contact with her is evidence for the baby that this is the same mother that he lived inside of for 9 months. So he knows from his experience that she has an inside, but he doesn't know really as if he could he possibly have occupied the totality of her internal world, interior world, when he was a fetus. Like the ones we studied, if he had a brother or a sister, he knows perfectly well that it wasn't absolutely exclusive and totally occupying the mother's internal world. So that there arises in the baby from two sources, both from the source of his own previous experience of living inside her, which also brings the question of what happened to the placenta. Why isn't it around? The breast isn't the same as the placenta. The placenta absolutely effortlessly and continuously supplied his needs and sang to him with its own soft voice. Whereas with the mother and with the breast, he has to make an effort. He has to make known that he wants it before it comes. It isn't just there always. It's obviously not the same as the placenta. So there's this problem of what happened to that friend or servant or part of himself that he lived with for those 9 months. That's one problem. And the other problem is what is going on when the mother and that breast and that mind are not immediately available to him, providing this reciprocity. And between those two conflicts and the advent periodically of real distress of hunger, of cold, of the awareness of something going on at his bottom that he was never aware of, in utero, something that feels quite sensually pleasant for a few minutes and then gets distinctly unpleasant in his napping. Those experiences, the consortium of those questions and experiences stress the baby's ability to maintain this passionate attachment, because the reciprocity is lost at those moments and all sorts of doubts and misgivings arise. Now, that oscillation between moments of passionate and reciprocated contact and other moments, hours, years, days, periods of time in which it is absent, stresses the baby beyond its capacity to hold together a passionate attachment. And all of the troublesome emotions of jealousy, envy, loneliness, persecution, suspicion, blah, 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 tend to arise at those moments. And what happens is that the baby cannot sustain this passionate attachment to this single object and begins to disseminate his links, which he does, first of all, by breaking up this consortium of interest, love and hate, this passionate attachment, breaking it up into different aspects. First of all, at least into three different categories, and disseminating them to different objects in the world about him, or to his own body, his own functions, and so on. But separating these three of love and hate and interest. That is the beginning of what Melanie Klein had described as the paranoid schizoid position, in which different objects are seen as idealized good and persecuting bad, and the world becomes very conflictual and untrustworthy and so on. But another thing happens also, and that is that a certain revulsion or aversion to the emotional impact of the mother that keeps reassembling this passionate attachment, a certain revulsion against it takes place, and the baby develops a certain negative attitude toward the impingement of an object that can arouse emotions of any sort. That the baby goes cold, you might say, goes emotionally cold. And he may go very quiet and be mistaken for a good baby. Or he may go emotionally cold and start biting the breast, or driving the object away by screaming at it and so on. But fundamentally goes cold. And that, of course, is the more serious aspect of what Melanie Klein describes as a paranoid schizoid position. But insofar as the baby struggles with this oscillation between moments of coming together in reciprocating passion and the moments of separation or failure of that conjunction, insofar as the baby struggles with it, he struggles to hold together his passionate feelings, and particularly to keep the tumultuous interface of loving and hating controlled and contained and held together by his interest. Now that interest, as I say, directs his attention also to the inside of the object, to the place where he used to be in his prenatal days, to the place where the placenta may still be if it wasn't murdered, to the place that may be occupied by all sorts of other objects, of which the father seems to be the prime suspect, as it were, of occupying that space. But the important thing is that that space and its qualities and its occupants bring into doubt the authenticity of the mother's reciprocating the baby's passion. Distrust is born, and the baby has virtually no way of settling in its mind this distrust, other than by thinking about its experience or by making certain kinds of experiments. Of these experiments, which are intended to test the authenticity of the object, the main type of experiment is an experiment in intrusion inside the object, what Melanie Klein described in 1946 as projective identification, of getting inside the object in fantasy. That is, in fantasy as far as the external mother is concerned, but very concretely in terms of the internal mother who has been formed and internalized in the course of these moments of reciprocation and happy passion. Very concretely entered and explored, but unfortunately, in a sense, what the baby or later on in childhood discovers to be the nature of that world inside this mother is in fact very different from what it experienced when it was a fetus. What it discovers is a highly structured world, compartmentalized, having all sorts of similarities in its formal qualities to the outside world, but having an entirely different social organization and a different ethos. What I've described as the claustrophobic world. So that is the most important and most, in the point of view of development, the most disturbing type of experiment that the baby makes, which is usually accompanied by its earliest masturbation activities or intrusion into its body orifices as the implementation of these fantasies of entering the mother's body. So that these experiments, the experimental approach to the problem of the mother's reliability and sincerity and authenticity, that experimental approach is in competition with the other approach, and that is the approach of observing and thinking about the baby's experiences with the mother. Now, observing and thinking turns out to be a very difficult thing to do, not only for babies, but for everybody, forever. And it's very difficult to do because it cannot be done consciously. It is so absolutely dependent on the operation of a system of mentality which is so different from calculation. It is so dependent on the experience of the qualities and particularly the emotional qualities of objects and relationships, that it does not lend itself to any kind of quantification that isn't so simplistic that it, the results of the calculation are always the same. The results of the calculation about emotional relationships are always the same because they always mean win or lose. Either you win and the other one loses, or you lose and the other one wins. There's no way of dealing with things quantitatively and getting away without coming up with a win or lose picture of the world. In order to think about the emotional experience in any way that has can make a contribution to the development of the child baby and child's personality, it has to rely on another function that is utterly unconscious and over which it has itself no control, and that is the function of symbol formation. Once it has this function of being called alpha function, once this function has provided it with symbols, it can think. It can think, and that means make up stories, which are really make up dream stories, and then think about them, and their consciousness can begin to enter into it, and sophistication, the ability to generalize, to abstract, to impose comparisons and memories and all sorts of aspects of judgment. It can, once it has the symbols to operate with, it can operate intelligently. And the problem, of course, is who makes these symbols? Where do they come from? And why don't they come? And what happens to them that sometimes they seem to come and then don't and disappear? Well, the implication seems to be is that symbol formation is something that really the baby gets from the mother. From the mother who does herself function emotionally and qualitatively through symbol formation and dreaming and thinking and so on, that the baby gets from the mother something which is at first external and comes from the mother, but is soon established internally as an internal mother, internal breast, internal thinking breast, but that is an internal object, not self, but object, that produces the symbols and supplies them, like the mother supplies milk to the baby, supplies them as the stuff with which thinking can take place. Now, with that sort of model of the mother, the baby-mother relationship as the primary emotional relationship in life that is then extended, extrapolated, repeated throughout life as at the foundation of the capacity for thought, the relationship to an internal mother and an internal breast mother, head, thinking, feeling. Now, operating with that model and recognizing the struggle that the baby has to maintain its trust in the mother and not to go making experiments and intruding into her in fantasy to try to find out the truth, as if the truth was something that can be discovered like gold in the mountain. That the baby's conflict between its rather feeble capacity to observe and think in order to struggle with this distrust and not to yield to the temptations to more experimental, concrete, and intrusive modes of relating to the mother, both internal and external mother, that conflict is seen really as something that continues through life, that it becomes intensified at every developmental step, because every developmental step in capabilities, in contact with the complexities of the world, with the acquisition of new information, new experiences, every developmental step naturally produces what Bean calls moments of catastrophic change, when the new experiences that the baby has, or the child has, is encountering, which are always, in a certain sense, a repetition of the first experience of birth and the moments of chaos before the baby found this breast, this thinking breast mother, that those moments of catastrophic change dismantle the whole apparatus and produce a state of not of madness, but just of total confusion, each of which, and again, it's Bean who points this out, is a moment both of danger and of promise, a moment that he calls a moment where breakdown or breakthrough are both possible and delicately balanced. That view of the developmental process and the view that happiness is the experience of developing has little or nothing to do with pleasure and pain, but to do with this process of developing, which means developing understanding of the world and understanding of oneself in relation to the world, which means in the first instance the baby and yourself with your mother and so on. That process of development and its nodal points of catastrophic change, which means that it's not a smooth inclined plane, but more like a staircase, that you hit these moments, these nodes of catastrophic change where you might just fall down and be destroyed or rise to a new level of understanding and interest. That view of development is a view that that makes it possible, it seems to me, to think of creativity as a possibility of this staircase of development. Now, if it is a possibility, one would suppose that it's a possibility that is a late possibility, that creativity is in no sense an innate capacity that will blossom like a flower given the correct nourishment. It would view creativity as something that is an immensely complicated and difficult of achievement, not only because it's dependent on also the acquisition of the skills that are necessary for giving form that can be also shared with other people, but mainly because the creativity involves a surrender that is in many ways terrifying. That is a surrender to those moments of catastrophic change in which the mind is utterly dependent on an internal object to supply a symbolic form of the emotional experience that pulls together again this capacity for interest and the emotional experiences and pulls them together into a passion, that that dependence upon the object to do that, to supply the symbolic link that enables thinking to begin to take place again, to replace the chaos of the the catastrophic change, that creativity would seem to be dependent on a fairly continuous process of that sort of surrender to absolute dependence on an internal object. And that kind of surrender seems to be almost impossible for human beings. Certainly as a continuous process, it would seem to be impossible. I mean, there's no artist whose life one studies who doesn't reveal the breaks and the discontinuities in creativity. Now, of course, the question arises then, if creativity is dependent, requires more than moments, but periods of absolute surrender to and dependence upon the internal object which can create the symbols, and if the creation of the symbols is really the essence of the creative process, of course the question arises, well, whose creativity is it? And the answer, of course, is that it's the creativity not of self, but of object. And of course, this is attested to by, as far as I know, all creative people, that they experience that their periods of creativity are periods in which they surrender to being used as the mouthpiece, the paintbrush, the composer, as the implementer of the creativity of an object in their mind whose purposes, as it were, and intentions are as unknown to them as they are to anybody else. That the creativity is essentially mysterious because it is not self. The self is simply the transmitter of the creativity of the object. And of course, this immediately brings you back to the religious model, the traditional religious model of the seer, the prophet, the oracles, and so on. The person who can allow himself to be used as a vehicle, as a spokesman, as an implementer of the creativity of the gods. And from that point of view, of course, the Kleinian Beyond model of the mind is essentially a theological model in which, from the baby's earliest passionate relationship to the mother, and particularly those moments of reciprocation, there is internalized a figure that is the most advanced part of the mind, far, far in advance of the self, which is the baby who's gradually learning to walk and to talk and so on, far in advance, and a part of the mind that has been in the process of formation for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That this is the aspect of mental development that is utterly non-Darwinian. That what is inherited in this non-Darwinian sense, which has probably little or nothing to do with the genes, but has to do with what we call culture, and particularly with language, that part of the personality that has inherited this tool of language, this thing that has taken thousands of years to fashion, that part of the personality is not self. It is the god of the personality, it's the teacher of the personality, it's the source of all feelings of security and of purpose and meaningfulness in life. And the creative person is the rare person who can surrender, at least for periods, to this total dependence on his object, on his internal object, and to be willing to accept this more humble and socially dangerous position of being the spokesman or the implementer of the creativity of this object.